Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the UC Irvine campus and streaming live at kuci.org. Today's interview was recorded on Thursday, March 11th, 2021. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here today with Willie Vlotten. Born and raised in Reno, Nevada, Willie's the author of 6 novels and is the founder of the bands Richmond Fontaine and the Delines. Inspired by songwriters and novelists Paul Kelly, Willie Nelson, Tom Waits, William Kennedy, Raymond Carver, and John Steinbeck, Vlotten works to tell working class stories in his novels and songs. Willie's been the recipient of 3 Oregon Book Awards, the Nevada Silver Pen Award, and was inducted into the Nevada Writers Hall of Fame and the Oregon Music Hall of Fame. He was a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award and was shortlisted for the International Dublin Literary Award. 2 of his novels, Motel Life and Lean on Pete, have been adapted as films. His novels have been translated into 11 languages. He teaches at Pacific University's MFA in Writing program. And he lives near Portland, Oregon with his wife, dog, cats, and horses. And he's here today to talk about his new novel, The Night Always Comes, published by Harper. And about the novel, Kirkus has said, Vlotten has written a soulful thriller for the age of soulless gentrification. Welcome to the show, Willie.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Oh, of course. It's my pleasure. Let's begin by talking about the inspiration for The Night Always Comes. How did the novel come about?
Well, I live 30 miles outside of Portland, but I live in the woods, you know, and I'd lived in Portland in the city for, I don't know, 15 years or something like that. And I started getting the itch to write back in the city. So there's a part of Portland called St. John's. It's like one of the last working class areas of Portland. And I have an office there. I've had an office there for 13 years or something like that. And I just noticed, you know, being a lazy bum, I write for a while, and then I just walk around the neighborhood. And I started realizing that all these little houses that they were, you know, built in the 40s and 50s, or the 20s through the 50s, for working class families, were, their prices were doubling and then tripling and then quadrupling. And in a course of 15 years, the housing prices in Portland have gone through the roof, and it just stuck with me. And at the same time, I started seeing you know, tent cities appearing in Portland, and homelessness just exploded in Portland. And I just kind of sat back and thought about gentrification. And then I thought about, you know, our last president, you know, had commented that the point is you can't be too greedy. And I started thinking about, well, how does greed look, not from CEOs, but from working, from a view of working class people, if looking out for yourself and greed is what is to be admired and what is talked about with our leaders, then how does that look? And it was a combination of all those ideas that made me just think about one family and the idea of how does a working class family, who's often, like most working class families, or most families in general, I suppose, they have a lot of burdens around them, a lot of weight each family carries. And how does a family like that deal with housing prices that have, you know, nearly quadrupled in less than 20 years?
Yeah. I'm curious if, is this how you tend to approach writing fiction? Is it something that you observe in life, something around you that inspires you, or do your novels begin all different ways?
I think, in general, I guess if I'm going to sit in, you know, in a room for a couple of years, it has to be something that's either bothering me or has scarred me or interests me. You know, I wrote a book called Lean on Pete. It's about low-level horse racing, and I was an avid, you know, I loved the horse track. I loved gambling on horses, and I just started realizing how beat up the horses and the jockeys were and how little money was to be made. And I started investigating it a little bit, and it kind of broke my heart to the point where I quit going to the races. And so I had to, so that was what got me to write Lean on Pete. It was just that it's kind of like heartbreaking. I can't figure it out. And so I write a novel around it. So I think I always kind of work that way around kind of bigger themes or themes that I can't let go or don't let me go.
Yeah. So back to The Night Always Comes. So you're walking around, you're observing what's going on in Oregon in general. And then what? Does it begin? Do you know that it's enough enough for a novel? Or do you begin just writing to see whether it's going to be a shorter piece or see if it's this or that? Or, you know, what happens next?
Well, I was, you know, it's all like kind of threads. And then I got interested in the idea to try to get in and buy a house or to give up. The idea of that if it's so stacked against you that you quit trying, which I think is a serious problem in the States, which is like to believe in the American dream or to just to give up and just try to get by and do whatever you can to scrape by. So I started thinking about that in terms of, you know, friends I've had who get so kind of beat up by their job or their life that they make bad moves. They buy expensive cars they can't afford. They buy guitars they can't afford. They use that kind of shop therapy because they feel so stuck. And so I thought about that in terms of this family and the idea of the daughter of this family. It's a mother and her grown 30-year-old daughter, and they have a 32-year-old son, brother, that is developmentally disabled. So they've kind of been this kind of union that have kind of relied on each other. And the daughter says, look, we need to buy this house before we get priced out. And then we'll have to leave the neighborhood and we'll have to live in a worse area. And the mom's like, but I'm tired of being poor. Can I just have something nice for a change? Just me. So the mom starts giving in to just buying things that or buying one thing in particular that just brings her a little peace and screws up the whole loan process and the process. So I just think about those things all kind of interspersed, like how working class families sometimes sabotage themselves, how sometimes it, you know, getting out of the trap of their situation is unattainable, so they give up.
Yeah, Lynette and Kenny and the mom, that it was so heartbreaking when the mother made that major purchase and kind of put the idea of a home loan kind of down the drain. I would imagine you were a little heartbroken when that happened too.
Yeah, you know, of course. And I think I've met a lot of people in my life that have made those kind of choices where they kind of, I don't know if it's self-sabotage or they just get so dejected day after day that they give up, and everybody gives up in different ways. And I think also I was interested in the ideas of the burdens of Lynette and her mother taking care of her brother Kenny their whole lives. So they've been burdened and they've been kind of beat up for a long time. And when you are beat up or when a family's beat up, they don't necessarily make the best choices. And I think Lynette is the one that still believes and still has the oomph in her, you know, she still has the belief that she can save her family. And I think the mom by this point is kind of given up.
Yeah. Where did Lynette come from?
I was interested in the idea of a kid being born almost an indentured servant. I think by the age of 8 or 9, she's been taking care of her brother. She's been her brother's caregiver. And so she's powerless. She's been kind of under this one umbrella, which is take care of her brother and get by and don't cause any grief to the mom, who the mom is struggling and just to make ends meet. And so I thought about powerlessness, and I thought Lynette was born into in a family where her job is to take care of her brother and her job is to not cause any more trouble than her brother causes. And you can't live that way. And so I think she doesn't really know how to love. She doesn't know really how to be herself. And she's powerless. And how she kind of deals with it is every once in a while she explodes in rage and devastates the people around her because she just explodes. And if anyone's been around that, it's tough to recover from. And I think when we meet her, she's tried really hard to make up for that. And she's also, I think, she's a woman that's, you know, kind of been tattooed by the life she was raised in. She can't escape the fact that she has a responsibility, at least in her mind, to take care of her brother. And now she sees her mother. So she's trying desperately to help them. And I think she's been stuck in that role for so long. It's just a part of her. And so it's pretty heartbreaking for her to her life's been pretty rough on her. And I think she's really just trying to save her family. And as much as she should probably just run from them, I don't think it's in her DNA to do that.
And what about Kenny? Where did Kenny come from? And when did you know he was a part of the story?
I mean, he was interesting because, you know, I had a good buddy that always, from when I knew him when like 17, I think, he worked with developmentally disabled people. And we used to go play guitar. I'm a guitar player as well. And late at night, he stayed at a group home. And then after he put all the guys to bed, it was a kind of an adult disabled men house. And he'd put everyone to bed. And then we'd go upstairs and drink beer and play guitars all night. And I think some of it came from that, but I was interested in that idea of the burdens that working class families have to carry. And it was also how I could keep Lynette and her mother together at an age where they shouldn't be together. And just the hardships of that are on this family already. And then you throw in gentrification. Some families can't rise above gentrification and a rapid change like that, and some families can. And I was interested in the family that's like on that razor's edge of failing, or maybe they'll get lucky. And in this case, Lynette sees that there is luck, that they can get this house. But I think the mom's, you know, blurred by years and years of you know, dead end jobs and grief. And I don't think she can see the future.
I'd love to hear you read from The Night Always Comes. Could you do that?
Yeah.
And if you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Willie Vlotten. His book is The Night Always Comes, published by Harper.
In the carport to the right of the house was a car she had never seen, a white Toyota Avalon Limited. It had no license plate, only a placard that said Toyota of Portland, and taped to the rear windshield was a white trip permit. Lynette parked on the street, got out, opened the passenger side door for Kenny, and helped him from the car. They were walked across the front lawn, and she stopped and looked inside the Toyota. The seats were black leather, and a clear plastic liner covered the carpeted floor. It was brand new. Inside the house, the curtains were shut, and the lights were off. Their mother lay on the couch underneath an electric blanket watching TV. She sat up when they came in. "Come here and kiss your mother," she said to Kenny. He walked slowly toward her, and her hand shook slightly when she lit a cigarette, put it in her mouth, and took hold of his arm. "Sit next to me." She patted the couch with a free hand. "Sit right next to Mommy." Kenny shook his head. "Once in a while you have to do what somebody else wants and not what you want, so sit." She squeezed his wrist as hard as she could and pulled him down to her. He moaned but sat. Lynette set her purse and keys on the table near the front door. "Whose car is that?" Their mother didn't answer. "Jesus, it's so awful out today." Lynette walked to the living room. "I don't know why you always have to have it so dark in here all the time. Do you mind if I turn up the heat, at least for a little bit? I can't seem to get warm today." "Sure," the mother said. Lynette turned the thermostat up to 68. "So whose car is that? It's really nice. Is it Cheryl's? Did yours break down?" Their mother had a cigarette in her left hand and kept her right hand around Kenny's wrist. Her eyes were on the TV, and her voice came out so quiet it was barely audible. "It's mine." Lynette laughed. "It's yours? I bet. Yeah, I bet. Their mom's voice grew louder, but now it was shaken. I bought it. Lynette looked at her suddenly worried. What do you mean you bought it? You mean you bought a car today while I was gone? You didn't go to work like you said? You bought a brand new car? Their mother was 57 years old and overweight by 40 pounds. She had dyed brown hair and was dressed in her work clothes, a black suit with a cream-colored blouse. On her feet were thick wool socks. She put the electric blanket over Kenny's legs, moved closer to him, and kept her right hand around his wrist. I didn't tell you because I knew you'd get upset. But I've been looking to get a new car for a long time, you know that. And those guys at Toyota of Portland, they're nice. They're not slimy at all. So I set up an appointment, and they had one. They had the one I wanted. I didn't even have to put money down, not a cent. And my payments aren't as bad as you'd think. They even gave me $1,500 for the Saturn, and as you know, that car was a death trap. The brakes were given out, and it didn't steer right. It needed new tires, too. The guys at Schwab said I shouldn't even be driving it. How much was it? It was a good deal. How much? Well, with everything in the better warranty, $39,000. Lynette sat on a wooden chair next to the front door. She covered her face with her hands, and her heart began racing. I'm really confused. We're supposed to sign the papers on the house next week. Is it going to screw up the loan? Did you think about the loan? Her mother shook her head. I remember when he wanted us to buy it for $90,000, and now he wants $300,000? He has a lot of nerve. It was 15 years ago he said 90. That was a long time ago. And he's selling it to us for $280,000. He's taking $20,000 off, and that's off what it's going to be listed if he puts it on the market. Plus, we're not going through realtors. So we're saving more. It's a really good deal, and you know it. I told you last week the blue house down the street sold for $400,000. Well, that place is a lot nicer than ours, and it's not on the freeway. I know, but still, Jesus, why would you buy a car today? I've wanted one for a long time, said their mother. So finally, I just bought one. That's it? You didn't think how it'll affect us getting the house? Their mother didn't answer. Kenny wanted to get up from the couch, but she wouldn't let him. Don't you want to still buy the house? Asked Lynette. Again, their mother remained silent. You know, if we don't buy it, he'll just sell it to someone else, right? And you know as well as me, we can't afford any other house around here. We'll have to get an apartment, and the apartment's going to cost more than the mortgage. Even a bad two-bedroom apartment around here is $1,500, and that's if we're lucky, and we only pay $800 now. If we buy this place, we'll have to pay around $1,200 a month, but still, that's less. That's $300 less a month than any apartment, and we'll finally own something. Their mother knocked the ash off her cigarette into an empty Coke can. Ah, he talks an awful lot, but believe me, he won't really sell. He said all this before. But this time is different. You know it. He already agreed to sell it to us. If we back out, he'll just put it on the market. He had a realtor come by. Don't you remember? She took pictures and everything. You were here when she did the walkthrough. He's tired and old, and he wants to sell. Their mother's hand shook as she picked up a Starbucks cup from the coffee table. Kenny grabbed for it, but missed. Don't, she yelled at him. Mr. Claremont's been nice to us, Lynette said. He's trying to help us. Help us? This house is horrible, and he hasn't fixed up anything in years. How can that be nice? Oh, that's not fair. Well, it is. It's true. Lynette closed her eyes, and her heart was beating so fast she thought she might vomit. Maybe I'll just end there.
That's great. Thank you so much. That was Willie Blaughton reading from The Night Always Comes, published by Harper. You know, it's great to hear you read. And as you were reading, I was thinking about your prose, about your sentences, because, you know, they're kind of perfect. And I was wondering if you read aloud at some point during the writing process.
Yeah, you know, I really do. I guess if I have one gift at writing at all, it's perseverance. And I edit a lot. Like, it doesn't take me that long to write the draft of a novel, maybe 8 months or a year or something like that. But then I'll spend another year or 2 years just tinkering on it, because it just takes me a while to get it right. And that's one of the things that I love about writing is it's not a performance. It's just grunt work. And I've never minded grunt work. But yeah, I go through, you know, the last stages of it. I always read it out loud.
What are you listening for?
I just want it to flow right. You know, I do everything off my gut. So like if my gut doesn't, if it doesn't feel right when I'm reading it, if it feels false or stuttery, or, you know, it just kind of messes me up, then I'll stop and fix it. And I, you know, I hate to admit this, but I think I am seriously addicted to audiobooks. I have trouble sleeping, sometimes. And so I listen to a lot of audiobooks, and I think because of that too, I think how it sounds out loud, maybe more than a lot of people.
Yeah. I love audiobooks too.
It's a bad it's a bad habit of mine, but I mean, hell, I could have a lot worse habits than staying up all night listening to audiobooks.
That's right. You know, I should have also listened to this. Well, this one must be on audio, but maybe not yet, because we're talking a little bit before the book is actually released. So be interesting.
Yeah, it's read. Yeah, it's, you know, I've done the audio, I've done the reading for all my book, well, for most of my books anyway, and I love it, but I'm a big fan of this audiobook reader narrator named Christine Lakin. Mm-hmm. and she read this one. I was really excited that she would read it, and I thought she did a great job.
So I would guess that's because you have a female protagonist.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of wanted, and I wanted someone that you could disappear into better than if it was me, and disappear into Lynette and the world better. And I thought it would do better if it wasn't me.
Talk about writing a female protagonist. What's the difference, and what are you looking for, or what are you concerned with, and yeah, talk about that. That's interesting.
I mean, I was raised by a woman, you know, and all the strong people, or I should say the probably the nicest people in my life growing up were women. And so I was just kind of surrounded with them. And I think I was, you know, my mom was, you know, a struggling single mother who talked a lot about her struggles. And so I think it just kind of, I always felt kind of comfortable listening to stories of working class women. And so I never thought of it much. And one of my drinking buddies in my early 20s was my cousin. And so when I write, and she's a great woman. So a lot of times when I write a story, I think of her. Like Lynette, I think it's my cousin. And so I just think about my cousin and I write it, and I don't think about her being a woman at all. She's just a person, you know, and I think men and women react to things differently. I think men and women react to powerlessness differently. I think, you know, if Lynette was a boy growing up with Kenny, I think it would be a different situation. So you think about things like that, but really I just kind of forget that she's a woman.
Interesting.
I don't think much about it. The cardinal sin that I've read a lot of books by men who write about women is they fall in love with them and they become their dream girl. And that's just like, you just got to put that on a big bulletin board above the computer every day when you're working. Is like, just don't fall in love with her. She's just a person. She's not a man or a woman. She's a human. And just write her story. So that's what I try to do. I don't know if I do it well, but that's what I try to do.
Well, I believed her. I thought she was pretty authentic. And I mean, it's she goes through some things. She has some troubles, and she is driven into danger and dealing with dangerous people. So I'm curious. I think it's difficult. Allowing your characters or making your characters encounter trouble, and talk about these things she goes through, and whether before you write the book, you have an idea of what those troubles are going to be, or are you following the story and just kind of amping up the conflict, amping up the obstacles as you go along?
I mean, usually I can start, like if we had a cup of coffee before I started the book, I could probably, over a single cup of coffee, I could probably tell you the arc of the novel. So I start with the basic idea of it in mind. I have the start, the middle, the ending. I have the big characters probably. And that's pretty consistent on all my books. With Lynette, I was interested in that idea of how does a working class person come up with she has to come up with $80,000 for a down payment, and she has 3 years to do it. This is before her mother comes home with that car that we just heard about. So she has 3 years till the landlord's going to sell. They've come up with a price, and she has to come up with $80,000 because her mother can only get a $200,000 loan. And so then you start thinking, well, how does a working class person come up with that kind of money? And so I kind of followed that trail. And then the nights where she's desperate and she's trying to scrape together all the money she can, I think I was trying to talk about greed. So many of the people she comes across are just looking out for themselves, when Lynette's really looking out just for her family and her community. And she encounters, you know, the old money of Portland, the new money of Portland. She comes across men that prey on the weaknesses of vulnerable women. She comes across all these different kinds of people, and all those people kind of represent different things and different obstacles she has to go through, but also different obstacles that like a working class woman would have to go through if she's desperate. So I was interested in that. And then you start ramping it up because she gets more and more desperate. And instead of stopping and saying, hey, I'm not going to get myself in danger anymore, she keeps going forward because she feels that that's the only option she has. A lot of times when you're desperate is when you shouldn't make decisions. And when you're desperate, you often feel you have to make life-changing decisions. And I think she's kind of caught in that. And at the same time, you know, she's a wounded, kind of damaged person. And we start seeing that as the novel progresses.
As you're talking, I was thinking that it sounds like you just have this ability, this natural kind of instinctual understanding of story. And then I began wondering about, you know, did you go through an MFA program? Where did you learn to write? Can you talk about that, how story comes to you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I started writing songs first. I was really shy, you know, like a really kind of almost clinically shy kid. And my brother was a guitar player, an older brother, and he's a guitar player, and he wrote songs. And he told me I should write songs that it'd make me feel better. So he got me, I'm left-handed. I tried to play his guitar, and I couldn't, and I quit. And he found a left-handed guitar and got my mom to buy it for me. And then I just started writing songs. And I always loved story songs, even from when I was like 11 or 12. I loved story songs because you could disappear into them. So any kind of rock or kind of folk song that could make you disappear was the song for me. And so I started writing those. And then as I got, like, you know, I was obsessive songwriter and obsessively bad. I was just bad. And you could argue I still am. But then when I was around 17, 18, I was also addicted to novels and movies, and I went through a phase where I couldn't find a book that I could disappear into, and I couldn't find a movie where I could. My big goal was to find a movie I could disappear into, and I'd fall in love with either a location or a girl in the movie, and then I could live inside that world in my head, you know, for a week, sometimes 2 weeks, before it would tap out. And so at 18, I went through a spell of like 3 months where I couldn't find anything that made me disappear. And obviously, I needed to disappear from who I was, I guess. So I just started writing a story that I could disappear into. So I just started writing a novel. And then I went to the local university, UNR in Reno, and I went to the office hours of the writing teacher, and I asked him how long a novel, what's the very shortest a novel could be, and he goes, oh, you know, I bet you could get away with it for 130 pages. And I said, oh, okay, and then I went back home and I wrote a book that was 130 pages, and then at 128, I wrapped it up, so it was done by 130, and I just got addicted to it, you know, and then I started taking night classes from that guy. And then he pawned me off on another professor at UNR, and I took some night classes, and then that was about it. I just like doing it, and I did it for, geez, maybe 15 years that way without really sending him out or anything. And then I got the confidence up when I was around 35 to send one out.
Hmm. That's also being very patient. You know, most writers are very impatient. And want to send stuff out immediately.
I just loved it so much. And, you know, I was never very good at anything really. And I was in a, you know, kind of like a working band from say 26 to, you know, till 35. And we never did very well. And so I wrote all the tunes. So I felt, and I was also really shy. So I got beat up a lot that way. And my songs got beat up, I felt, and I didn't want to do that to writing because I just liked doing it. It was, you know, I used to take vacations just so I could sit home and wake up and write stories. I used to quit jobs. I used to quit jobs to work out a first draft, and knowing that I would never show anybody or send it off. I just really liked doing it, and I liked disappearing into a story, into a different world, even if the world's rough, like Lynette's world's rough, but at least you can be with her and kind of help her out, or at least be your pal while she's going through it. Something about being in a rough situation when you're writing takes away the worry of a rough situation for myself, if that makes sense.
Mm, that's interesting. Did you have the ending in mind when you were thinking about this book and sort of putting it together in your mind? Did you know where it was going to be?
You know, I had a couple endings. You know, I made a couple blunders. The thing I always think about writing is when you make a mistake in writing, it's like, I always think of writing as like you're digging a ditch, but you're not really sure where the ditch is going, but it takes as long as digging a ditch. So you're digging a ditch without a concrete map, I guess, or a, you know, clear path. And I wrote, you know, almost 200 more pages of the novel, after the ending. And it just didn't work. So I had to cut it. But yeah, I knew the basic ending.
What about the beginning? Was this always the very beginning, this first line, Kenny had his hands around her ankle and began pulling her from the bed?
Well, I just like the idea of like, here's this gal that's working two jobs. And then all she's asking is, and she has to get up at like, you know, 4:35 every day because she works at a bakery. And then, yeah, I just wanted to like, okay, this is just a normal day for her. Her brother, comes down and wakes her up early when he's not supposed to. It just shows you where she's at. And also kind of the grind she's on. So yeah, I was interested in that. And, you know, the mom buying the car, I thought, you know, that is, I've seen that happen. A good buddy of mine did that. You know, he was really in debt and really depressed, and he bought a brand new car because he thought it would make him less depressed and he'd feel better and he'd be able to cope with the big, you know, the big mountains of problems he'd gotten himself into. And I was heartbroken by it. I kept saying, a car's not going to change you, man. You know, a car's not going to make you happy. Maybe it will for a couple of weeks, but it's not. And so that's kind of where I got the idea for the car for the mom, because the mom, I think, saying like, look, I'll feel better about myself. I'll like myself more when somebody passes me or I pass somebody on the road and they see I'm in a nice car. It'll make me feel better about myself. And Lynette, you know, Lynette says like that, you know, that's crazy. That won't happen. You're still you. So some stuff from real life, you know, gets into my stories, but some ideas get into it, but then the story just kind of takes place because of the themes I'm thinking about.
And beginning, kind of beginning in the middle of things, as writers are always told to do, this first chapter just draws you right in, and you very quickly feel as a reader that you know who these people are.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, you know, I've never read a book on writing or anything like that. I just wanted you to just dip into the grind of her life and how, you know, how hard she works and the family dynamic. And so I thought it was just a good place to start.
So the novel to me is literary fiction, but it has shades of noir, and there's, you know, some thriller elements too. Do you think about categories when you're writing, and how would you categorize your novel?
I mean, I've always wanted to write novels. When I first started writing, I wanted to write novels for friends of mine, guys mostly, that didn't read. I wanted to figure out a way to write maybe a noir crime novel without the crime, meaning that I wanted a book that you could read on the bus or if there was a TV going on or life around you, like they could keep your interest. So I was always interested in writing really simple, my style would be simple and direct, and hopefully written in with some kind of urgency, written with blood, and also intimate, and not confusing. Maybe the issues are deeper if you want to think about them that way. But initially, when you're reading it won't slow you down. So if you're tired and you get off work, that maybe you'll read it, and it won't make you put it down and turn on the TV. But I never think about it as far as genre. I always just thought about it like, if you could. My favorite books are the ones that kind of they grab you and they don't let you go, and they make you feel like they're a part of you, and there isn't a genre or like a hook there to grab you. That being said, you know, in my early 20s, I went to a bookstore in Reno, and they had a display for Black Lizard books, and it was like a maniac cowboy kind of guy that looked like he just got out of a mental asylum and a prison, and he's kind of holding a gun, and in his chest were all these black and white covers of paperbacks, and the paperbacks were by people like Jim Thompson and Charles Williford and David Goodis, and they were all really short, like under 200 pages, and they're all kind of damaged. Their stories of damaged people and doing sometimes illegal things, but the crime of them was not wasn't the issue. It wasn't like a procedural. It was damaged people writing about damaged people, and I loved them. So maybe there's some of that in this book as well, because I've been rereading a lot of that stuff, and I just reread Postman Always Rings twice, and that kind of those like hard-boiled 1930s books that are really thin and really intense. I do have, you know, a love for those. So maybe some of The Night Always Comes has that.
I just reread The Postman Always Rings Twice as well. And there is something to it, right? It's just a story that grabs you right from the start and doesn't let go.
And the thing about like Postman Always Rings Twice that I thought was interesting is it's psychologically really intense without explaining it. It's they just go on this weird tangent. Cora and Frank, I think his name is, they get caught up in this kind of passion lust situation, and they don't. Kane doesn't really explain it. You just kind of feel it, and I think that's amazing, because he doesn't have to spoon feed it to you. He just sends you on this journey, and for whatever reason, you feel like you're a part of it, and you feel the lust and the romance between Frank and Cora, and the danger of them, and the horribleness of them in a lot of ways. I really liked it. I am influenced by that kind of stuff, sure.
Yeah, and it's, you know, when I read it, it was pretty recent, maybe 2 months ago, I reread it.
That's cool, me too.
And I was just noticing how instructional it was for a writer, you know, just in terms of like what you said, showing showing these people, showing what they're dealing with, instead of explaining. And maybe that's part of the reason why it can be a shorter book, because it's just all there on the page. I mean, it's very filmic. No wonder it was made into a film. And, yeah. You know, just so I was thinking, you know, with your stuff, same thing. It's very filmic, and you've had two other novels made into films. And I wondered if that was surprising to you, or if you then understood why maybe that happened.
I mean, before we forget, you know, Stanley Tucci, the actor, he reads Postman Always Rings Twice. And I actually, I was driving around today listening to Postman Always Rings Twice in my car. And he does a brilliant job of reading it. So you should check that out. I always think of, when I'm writing, I always think it's a movie, I guess. I really do think in that those kind of terms. But in regards to my own stuff being movies, you know, I never really thought about it. When it first happened, it was just really fun. And it has been really fun. I've never really thought about it much or taken it too seriously because I love the novel so much. And I've been so scared of, getting pushed around. Like, everyone has told me such horror stories about getting involved with movies that, and life's short, and I love tinkering on novels more than anything. So I've never really had interest in getting involved with it in any way. I just kind of, sell it to the person that's interested that I think could do the best job. And then I put my head back into the sand and just, you know, keep my little tugboat going in its direction. And, I don't think about it much, but I have to say it's really fun. You get a few free dinners out of it. I paid my house off with it. And people are nice to you, and Jesus, anytime somebody's nice to you, it's better than the opposite, I should say.
Sure is. Were you happy with the production of The Motel Life and Lean on Pete?
Yeah, you know, I mean, with The Motel Life, I really liked it because it was shot in Reno right before. Reno's kind of in a massive gentrification shift, and it's in a shift away from a casino town. And they caught the tail end of it, where they shot a lot of the movie in places I grew up going to. So I'll always be indebted to that, because I'll always have like a marker of all these places I used to go to. And then Lean on Pete, I had just an amazing experience with Andrew Haig, an English director. He wrote and directed it, and he was just such a nice guy, and he tried so hard on it. You just hope your story holds up, you know, and you don't let him down. But he was a pleasure, just a really cool guy. So all in all, movies are great because all the people involved with it, no matter the aspect of their job on the movie, generally love novels, movies, and records. And I get along with most people if they like one of those. So movie people are fun because they like, you know, most of them are pretty well read, and all of them like music, and of course they love movies.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. I have been with Willie Vlotten. His book is The Night Always Comes, published by Harper. And if you just tuned in, you're a little bit late, but we have a few minutes left, and this show will be podcast following the broadcast. So wherever you get your podcasts, I know on iTunes you can subscribe. We're on Stitcher. We're here and there. So please subscribe and listen to the full show and to the other shows that we have podcasts. I wanted to ask you about teaching, because you teach in an MFA program, and I'm curious how you teach writing, and if what you see skews more toward literary writing, or because it seems like a lot of programs are not really geared or interested in genre writing at all. And so I'm just curious how you teach.
Well, you know, I kind of fell into it. There's Pacific University south of Portland, and they just invited me. And, you know, like I said, I never, and it was a low residency. You meet for 10 days in the winter and 10 days in the summer, and then you get students. But in a way, it's like getting a free MFA for me. I just sit there and I get to hang out with all these really nice teachers and writers. And I'd never had any experience with it. As far as me, I love when people write working class stories. And I love when people write, beat up people stories, like when somebody's a bit dented or damaged. I love those kind of stories. And then really, I just try to be a cheerleader and try to hook them up with the books I think would help them the most. And I don't know if I'm good at it. I don't know. I'm insecure about it, that's for sure. And I don't do it full time. It's kind of like a part-time thing. And more than anything, I think it's just nice to be around people that like books. And it's really hard to meet people that are in love with literature. And then, a couple times a year, I get to go hang out at Pacific and get to be around people that are ruining or saving their lives or whatever you want to say by trying to write novels.
Well, you mentioned working class characters, and I wanted to talk about that in terms of your work because it does seem that working class characters are not often portrayed in fiction, or maybe at least a lot of the fiction I'm coming across, although that's what I write. And so what do you think about that? I mean, James Baldwin, I recall he said something to the effect of, writers need to write about people working because nobody's ever writing about people working and nobody works in fiction. And so I'm also thinking that with working class characters, that unless I'm reading noir or reading, something a little darker, they're pretty average upper class, normal people going through trouble, but yeah.
For me, I read all of Steinbeck's major novels by the time I was 16, and that was because I read them all in school. So I grew up in a really vulnerable that age where I was listening to, the Clash and the Jam, these kind of like English working class bands. They were singing about workers' rights, and then I'm reading Steinbeck, and then I'm also coming. Every time I come home from school and my mom gets off work, she's talking about how hard her job is and being she was sexually harassed for years at her job, but she was too scared to leave because she had my brother and me. And I got to see, her not get paid as much as the men, her messed with by the men. And I think it just kind of stuck into me. But you're right. And I said from an early age, I've always wanted to write those stories. Like, why can't a janitor be a hero? Why can't my mom be a hero? Why can't a checker at a grocery store be a hero? And so that's always been my belief. And that's the other sad thing is I've never done anything else. But, my peak of working is a house painter. So I've always worked those kind of jobs. You're right. There's not a lot of working class writers that everyday people know, except maybe Steinbeck, they care about the working class. And I think a lot of that in literary fiction is really disappeared. It's really hard for literary fiction to be interested in working class fiction. But where they're really interested in it is in crime, mm-hmm. is in noir. And so maybe that's why I was drawn to it. And nowadays, it seems like working class stories and socially conscious working class stories are usually framed in a crime book. George Pelicanus is a great example. He writes really great, crime novels set in Washington, D.C. area. But he always writes about like really cool themes like violence against dogs, dog fighting. He'll write about handguns. He writes about these big social issues that affect working class people, but he frames it in a way that people will be interested enough to read about it. So I've always had a lot of admiration for crime fiction because they deal with and talk about working class issues.
Yeah, and you just mentioned social issues. You know, it seems that crime fiction deals so much with social issues and things people are going through, that those who do not read crime fiction, and they go, why would I want to read that? You know, it's, you know, why would I want to? Well, let me name a few reasons why.
Well, I think also, how do you get an upper middle class person to read about working class people? The only way to do that in a lot of to a lot of people is to do it through the eyes of a detective, because everybody loves detective stories. And, you know, the detective kind of holds your hand and walks you into this situation, but you're not a part of it. You don't have to be among them. You're a voyeur into this world, and you have a guy hanging out with you that's a little bit like you. Maybe it's that, and maybe that's why that stuff's so popular. But you're right. If you had a book about a working class family, and you just write this, their straight struggles, it probably wouldn't be interesting to a lot of upper middle class people who are generally the novel readers. But mm-hmm. if you add a detective into it and a crime into it, maybe they will read it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Good point. Well, we're almost to the end of our time, and we cannot end without talking about what the world has been going through and is hopefully coming toward an end, and to more freedom, physical freedom. But how's it going for you writing-wise? How has this all affected your work?
I mean, I got to say, I hate even saying this because I feel guilty, but you know, this is the longest I've been home in 20 years, because I'm in a band and I tour quite a bit. And I tour quite a bit for my books as well. And I've been home for a year, so I just get to work on one project from start to finish, and it's really fun. So, you know, and I live in the woods outside of 30 miles north of Portland. And so it's been pretty lucky for me. You know, as a writer, it's been a pleasure, because I can just work and not pull off it and go to do something else. So I've had a really good time. I got a new dog, and, you know, I live next to a bunch of logging land. So I just been working on stories and hanging out with my dog and my wife. And it's not bad, man. I mean, I got to say, I'm getting to be more of a agoraphobic, but Jesus, I've always been agoraphobic anyway. So it's not so bad.
Will COVID find its way into any of your work?
Or you the only way I wrote this, I'm working on this novel about a house painter set in St. John's, this area of Portland. They kind of, Lynette, I'm writing kind of like three books kind of set in this one area. And in this novel, two guys have teeth go bad on them, like have a bad tooth. And right when COVID was at the worst, I had this tooth of mine went bad. And, you know, like tooth pain, it's pretty miserable. And I couldn't find anybody that would see me, you know, because this was right when everybody was really freaked out. And so eventually I found a dentist that would see me. But in the novel, there's two different guys that have teeth go bad on them, and I'm leaving them in because it cracks me up that you know how real life gets into your fiction, even when you're writing a completely fictional story. You know, your day to day life often gets inside those stories just because your day to day life is a part of these stories.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that's right. People were. Well, and still are to some degree kind of freaked out about going to medical offices, and I don't know.
Yeah, and this was right when when they were all shut down, and I had to just call. And luckily my wife's brother knows a dentist, and he was like, oh yeah, man, I'll see him. Because, it was one of those things where, like, you know, when you know it's bad when you're having fantasies about ripping your own tooth out with a pair of ice grips. That's when you're like, okay, I might need to get some help here.
That's funny. Well, we're at the end of our time, tragically, but I wonder if you have any advice for the writers who are listening.
Geez, I wish I did have advice. I guess the only advice I really do have is if you pick a story that you really believe in and a world you really believe in, then it doesn't really matter if it's a success or a failure, or if you publish it or just put it under your bed or destroy it when you finish it. Because for me, just being inside a different world like that is such a pleasure, and it's so fun tinkering on them that I think if you can disappear into a story you really believe in and work hard on it, that's victory in itself. That's enjoyment in itself and powerful, and you'll learn a lot. So, you know, maybe that's better than anything is that than always putting pressure on yourself to sell it or be published, or what do people think of it? Do they think I'm crazy for sitting in my room all this time? I don't know. And Jesus, at least it's a cheap way to waste your time. if it might drive you crazy, you might go nuts, but at least it's pretty cheap to just sit in a room by yourself and make up stuff.
Mm. Yeah. Good advice, actually. Very good advice. Willie Vlotten, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time. Oh.
Well, thank you very much, too.
Yeah, thank you. That was Willie Vlotten. His book is The Night Always Comes. Come back next week. We'll be right here. In the meantime, stay in the chair and keep yourself writing.
As I was on the floor, the weight of something wouldn't we? The weight of something wouldn't we? If I was in your life instead of out the door, the weight of something wouldn't we? The weight of something wouldn't we? Take flight.